Re-energizing NATO, today, Friday, September 5th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. NATO touts its decision to create a new rapid reaction force for Eastern Europe. This expert says setting up the force is the easy part. The big question now is when to use it.
The key to using it is that all the allies agree that a crisis is indeed a crisis.
Also today, Scots grapple with whether to vote yes or no on their independence referendum.
I'm leaning today, the swingometer is over more towards a yes.
And later, a Peruvian twist on Chinese fried rice.
Instead of seeing it with like bell peppers or pineapple or something you'd see in America or broccoli, here they have it topped with big giant corn kernels embedded throughout the fried rice.
Those stories ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The word ceasefire has been used a lot this summer. Israelis and Palestinians managed to stick to a recent ceasefire in hostilities in Gaza, and another ceasefire announced today, this one to calm the fighting in eastern Ukraine. The thing about ceasefires, in the midst of conflict, it's hard to say whether they will lead to lasting peace. But with Ukraine, this much is certain. The conflict there has already galvanized the North Atlantic Treaty Organization into action. At their meeting in Wales, President Obama and 27 other NATO leaders approved a new rapid reaction force. To find out just what that means, we turn to Julian Lindley French. He's a NATO expert at the Institute of Statecraft in London.
In a sense, it's all wine in new bottles. It's a multinational rapid reaction force, some 5,000 strong. The objective of the force is to provide what is known as strategic reassurance to the allies in the Eastern Alliance in the event of aggression by Russia. There are some new aspects of it. Pre-positioning of equipment in the Eastern Allies is a new thing. And in a sense, it builds on the old 1980s, 1990s reforger exercises the Americans led, by which, in a sense, this force would be the first responder to any act of aggression, waiting for the U.S. 7th Cavalry to come riding over the horizon.
Do you think this rapid reaction force, though, is going to be a calming factor, or will it be provocative?
Look, let's be clear. NATO is made up of sovereign, independent, free states. There is no sense of any of this force ever being outside NATO's borders. If those free sovereign states collectively together decide that that force should be stationed on their territory, it is their sovereign right. Now, if others, most notably Moscow, decide that it is an act of aggression, well then, clearly that says more about Moscow's state of mind than that of the alliance. But it's absolutely critical, let me be clear about this, that NATO reassures all its allies that their defence is meaningful. I made a speech in Riga a couple of years ago where I put to NATO leaders the need to pass the Riga test, that the people, the citizens of Riga, Latvia, can sleep safe in their, sound in their beds, safe in the knowledge that NATO's collective defence is real and meaningful. Therefore, given events elsewhere, as we speak, in Europe, in Ukraine, it strikes me as absolutely critical that those good people of Riga must be reassured that NATO is indeed their collective defence.
Yeah, do you think 5,000 troops will provide that reassurance?
Well, it's a tripwire, as I said. 5,000 will trigger a much bigger response downstream should, heaven forbid, we ever find ourselves in that kind of crisis. But I do think it's entirely appropriate, as the Secretary General has said, that NATO takes these steps to reassure all allies, East, West, North American and European, that NATO is a credible alliance in the 21st century.
Well, in addition to this rapid reaction force, NATO agreed to some other measures like NATO holding military exercises in Ukraine, which is not a NATO member, of course. What do you think the reaction is going to be in Moscow to all of this?
Well, it depends on the nature of this ceasefire. My sense of Moscow, to be blunt, is that if they effectively create a protectorate built around Donetsk and Luhansk, and they achieve a corridor between Russia and Crimea. My sense is that they've got what they want. The rest of Ukraine can be Europe's problems. Remember, given the depth of the Eurozone crisis, for many Europeans, the NATO meeting wasn't the most important meeting this week. It was the meeting of the European Central Bank in a desperate effort to solve the now permanent Eurozone crisis. The idea that the Europeans would be saddled with the cost of saving the broken Ukrainian economy might appeal to some Moscow strategists if they've achieved what they want, which is basically to hive off those parts of eastern Ukraine into some form of protectorate, which strikes me as being the real Russian political objective.
Julian Lindley-French at the Institute of Statecraft in London, thanks so much for your time.
Not at all. Thank you, Marco.
NATO leaders also agreed today to add cyber defense to the alliance's mission. Basically, that means they could now consider a military response if any member nation's digital infrastructure suffers a major virtual hit. Kenneth Gears is glad the alliance has taken such threats seriously. He's an ambassador for the NATO Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence in Estonia. It's a research center that promotes high-tech cooperation among NATO partners.
Well, I think NATO, just like the rest of us, is wondering whether cyber war is myth or reality. But if you're a national security decision maker, you don't have the luxury of treating it as an academic question. NATO must look to the future. And cyber war skeptics largely are falling away because we realize now that not only are there traditional vulnerabilities to any operation or organization, but there are vulnerable routers, operating systems, applications upon which we all depend. And if a hacker takes control of a system, of course, then they become its owner. And when the system is managing critical infrastructure, and in a military case, even the firing and logistics associated with weapon systems and military deployments, you realize that everything, including national security, now is connected to the internet.
Is NATO playing catch up with Russia in terms of cyber war?
Well, I think so. Nation states are ahead of everybody else because they have military and intelligence organizations with classified programs that have been working this issue for a very long time. Don't forget that the internet is a DOD project. And in the Soviet Union, they used to hack into the Pentagon way back 30 years ago. So obviously, organizations that are just trying to get up to speed on defense, as NATO is today, they're behind in the game because first-tier intelligence organizations and advanced militaries have been employing computer network operations for some time.
So with this NATO cyber pledge coming up this week, how will these countries work together, the NATO countries?
Well, I think they have to. Because cybersecurity is inherently an international problem, it requires an international response. Because cyberspace is bigger than any one country. It's bigger than the United States or France or Russia. So NATO and the European Union are the best places, frankly, to start chipping away at the anonymity of the attacker, as well as building a coalition of the willing in cyberspace, as well as to share best practices in computer security and the latest intelligence regarding threat actors.
I mean, the U.S. neither confirms nor denies it even has cyber weapons. So do you think this pledge will actually work?
I think so, because the internet is an international space, and there may be a lot of toes that you have to step on around the world in order to get the information that you need, even if it's just purely a defensive operation. And it's a difficult problem to solve, that you have to leverage potentially networks in third-party countries in order to conduct your operation, simply because that's the way the infrastructure is designed. But due to the nature of compartmentalized or sensitive operations, there's no alternative. So cyber operations are sensitive, but in this day and age, it is necessary for militaries to have this capability if they want to fight 21st century wars.
Kenneth Geer is the NATO Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence Ambassador. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's an honor. Pleasure.
Of course, 21st century conflicts aren't entirely virtual, not yet anyway. Our next story is about a very real on-the-ground development of the war in Syria. Al-Qaeda militants and other rebels are now in control of a key border crossing between Syria and land held by Israel. Now, this is the first time that's happened, and many Israelis find it very unnerving to suddenly have Al-Qaeda virtually on their nation's doorstep. Daniel Estrin sent us this report.
Well, it could be a little bit dangerous, even that today it's a very quiet day, okay? So let's stand behind this wall.
Gabi Kuniel took me to the roof of an abandoned building to get a bird's-eye view of his vineyards and apple orchards. They're in a beautiful hilly area of the Golan Heights. The climate is perfect for growing fruit. The location, not so much. His fruit trees grow right next to the border fence that separates Syria from territory Israel captured in 1967 and later annexed. Israel and Syria are technically still at war, but for decades this frontier was quiet. Then 3 years ago, the Syrian civil war broke out. And now, it's not so quiet along the border fence.
What's going on in these last 3 years? You hear it? So what's going on in the last 3 years is that you don't know who's the group who control our fence.
What is that?
The shooting.
Rebels in Syria have been fighting to control this border since the civil war began. Last week, the rebels won. A group of opposition fighters overran Syrian troops at the border and captured a group of UN guys who were monitoring the UN-mandated buffer zone between Syria and Israeli-held territory.
There was a big fight.
Israel does not want to open up a new front to the Syrian war, so Israel's army has mostly held its fire, responding only to occasional mortar fire when it lands in Israeli-held territory. Last week, when the fighting on the other side of the border got fierce, the Israeli army ordered Kuniel's 200 workers out of the orchards and vineyards. The Israeli army wasn't in the fight, but mortars fired from Syria landed in Kuniel's fields, setting them on fire. Whole patches of his lands are black now. The heat from the nearby fire scorched the grapevine, leaving it dry and crisp to the touch.
You see? It's all brown. Brown leaves.
Burn leaves. The smoke from the fire gave the grapes a musky taste. Not great for premium wine. It's cost Kuniel $200,000. But that's not what worries him. It's the Al-Qaeda fighters driving in trucks just feet away from his fruit trees that concern him more. The rebel capture of the border crossing here is significant. It was the Syrian government's last major stronghold in the strategic Golan Heights. Kuniel says the extremist fighters actually make him miss Israel's longtime foe, Syrian President Bashar Assad.
We saw what's going on in the last 6, 7, 8 months in Iraq, in Syria. So we prefer Assad and not Al-Qaeda here.
The UN force was set up in 1974 as part of the ceasefire between Israel and Syria. And it's one reason why people like Kuniel felt some measure of security. But the rebels are in charge now, and they've got control of the entire length of the border. Israeli defense officials say they believe the Al-Qaeda fighters do not pose an immediate threat to Israelis. Their sights are set on battles within Syria. But Israeli analysts say Al-Qaeda rebels do see Israel as a legitimate target, and now they're at Israel's front door. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, the Golan Heights.
Those captured UN troops are still being held by the militants in Syria. UN officials are demanding their immediate release. The 45 soldiers involved are from Fiji, by the way. They're part of a pretty large contingent of Fijian troops working with the UN around the globe. Coming up later in the show, we visit a UN compound in Iraq where Fijian soldiers often prepare for their duties by singing.
Part of a village set up back at home is communal activity. And part of it is singing as well, both in religious activities and traditional activities. And for us, it's just natural. If anyone starts singing, every other people around comes in harmonizing.
We'll hear what that sounds like ahead on The World. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Debates in the British Parliament are always fun to listen to. I mean, come on, even the country's prime minister is not above a little rambunctiousness.
What we need to do, both in Britain and Europe, is to combine the fiscal deficit reduction with innovative ways of using our hard-won credibility, which we wouldn't have if we listened to the muttering idiot sitting opposite me.
Not exactly debate at its finest there, but still, the British parliamentary style of debate is a model that's emulated all over the world. And one surprising place where it's growing in popularity is China. Educators there have been trying to get students to think for themselves a bit more. Here's a report from Ruth Morris in Shanghai.
First, a quick primer on British parliamentary debate, BP debate as it's called.
This DVD will be teaching you the British parliamentary formats. There are two sides in a BP debate, the government side and the opposition side. Each side has two teams with two members.
British parliamentary debate might seem out of place in China, where there is no opposition side. The Communist Party scrubs dissent from the internet and is constantly stressing harmony and social stability, not disagreement. But BP debate is gaining popularity here, especially among top students gunning for foreign universities.
Do you have 15 minutes of preparation time? Once again, we'd like to stress that you can't use any outside help, you can't call your friend.
The inaugural Shanghai International Debate Open starts with 100 students fidgeting in a small auditorium. Volunteers wear black T-shirts with English lettering. The shirts say, "Go back and read more." The first topic, or motion, appears on a screen.
The motion for first round is that this house regrets the celebritization of the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge.
As soon as they find out what they're debating, a couple of students scramble to find out what exactly the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge is. It was popularized on Facebook, which is blocked in China, although it did spread to Chinese social media. They rush to a judge with questions, and she fills them in.
It's a game where people take a bucket of ice.
Then the students pair off in teams and head to debate rooms.
Mr. Speaker, members of the House, they're saying that Ice Bucket Challenge is a kind of entertainment, so it's wrong.
So we want to use debate as a medium to give student education and enlightenment in a way.
Zheng Bo is the tournament's chief adjudicator and a promoter of BP debate in China. He says China's education system is grounded in Confucian thinking, which poses a challenge.
Teachers are given an absolute authority, and students just listen and recite and remember. So that created a lot of students that's really good in doing like math when there is a given answer. But when it comes to something without a standardized answer, that's creating a lot of trouble because they are not like familiar with this kind of practice.
Debate is the perfect educational supplement, he says. It trains students to think critically. An American judge at the tournament tells me motions tend not to veer into highly sensitive areas, like Tibetan independence. But he says topics still range widely, and debates about government policy are not off the table.
My name is Steve Cho. I'm from Beijing University of Aeronautics and Astronautics.
Cho is a participant. He says debate has taught him to step back from political flashpoints and take a more reasoned approach. For example, China's emotionally charged maritime dispute with Japan.
Primary education taught you to love your country, to be patriotic, to not betray your country and praise other countries like Japan. But through debate, we see that even though you do not praise your country, it doesn't necessarily mean you are not patriotic.
There's another life skill on display here. Let's call it the art of the practiced brush-off. In this motion, a speaker who goes by the English name Sloan is arguing that police should be able to bear arms. She allows a question from an opposing team member, but then slaps it down in a flash.
Okay, I already said that. Please listen to my speech. Moving on to the analysis coming from the lower house.
Sloan tells me BP debate is still young in China, and the overall number of debaters is still small. But she believes it'll keep growing.
It sort of have this kind of lifelong influence on you. So I think this kind of experience will go with you for a lifetime. So this kind of critical thinking will always with you and influence the people around you.
Participants also tell me they consider debating in English to be easier than in Chinese. In English language debates, you can be simpler and more direct, they tell me. And Chinese debates tend to have really abstract topics, like is IQ more important than EQ?
You're here?
Zhong Bo, the adjudicator, convenes the final round and reads the motion. It's not China-based, but it's highly controversial.
This House believes that the International Criminal Court should prosecute the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for hate crimes against Palestinians.
Ladies and gentlemen, why we think the opposition side today is kind of irresponsible to the...
Sloan made it to the finals, and I catch up with her afterwards. She found the motion tricky.
I'm not familiar with the regional conflict in this area, so a lot of what I just said might not be so true.
Team Mooney the Great. Please, come to the front.
Zhang Bo announces Sloan's team is a runner-up. One of the winners is from Hong Kong, where many residents are currently demanding greater democracy from Beijing. That subject didn't come up in the debates. Before Zhang Bo lets the students go, he offers his own critique of the final debate. It lacked historical context, he says, and concrete examples. He tells the debaters, go back and read more. For The World, I'm Ruth Morris in Shanghai.
Ruth sent us pictures of some of the debate contestants. You can see them at PRI.org. A quick note before the break. In this corner, mouse number one, Dead Mouse, who happens to be a Canadian DJ based in Toronto. In the opposite corner, mouse number two, Disney's very own Mickey Mouse. Who gets to wear the mouse ears? That's the question at the center of a legal battle. Dead Mouse, whose real name is Joel Zimmerman, wears an oversized mouse ear helmet when he spins music. It's also the logo on his albums and merchandise. Disney says, back off, Dead Mouse. Your ears are too similar to our Mickey Mouse trademark. Last year, Zimmerman tried to register his mouse ears logo with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Disney set out to block him. And this week, the company presented the Trademark Office with a side-by-side comparison of the two logos, claiming Zimmerman's was likely to cause confusion and damage the Disney brand. After all, Disney contends, Mickey Mouse is recognized as among the greatest animated characters of all time.
I'm Mickey Mouse. You know, Mickey Mouse? I hope you've heard of me. I hope.
Zimmerman's message to Disney's animated celebrity? Lawyer up, Mickey. That's what the Canadian DJ tweeted to his 3 million followers, along with this. Disney thinks you might confuse an established electronic musician performer with a cartoon mouse. That's how stupid they think you are. By the way, Zimmerman's Dead Mouse logo is already trademarked in 30 other countries, and here in the U.S., his lawyer says the DJ will not be bullied by Disney. Dead Mouse has until October 12th to present his case before the Trademark Office. Looks like the gloves and the ears may come off. We've got our own taste test of the Dead Mouse and Mickey Mouse logos at PRI.org. You play the judge and decide for yourself. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, Scottish comedian Janie Godley pays tribute to Joan Rivers and her tough brand of humor. She says female comics in Britain are too tame.
They'll talk about their boyfriends, they'll talk about being fat, they'll talk about cats. In America, you've got Maria Bamford, you've got Sarah Silverman, you've got Joan Rivers. In Britain, we have people that talk about cake.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World from the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The death of Joan Rivers isn't just an American story. Rivers is being remembered around the globe, too, as a Hollywood icon and a pioneer who paved the way for female comedians everywhere. Rivers was well known in Britain, where none other than Prince Charles issued a statement saying he's deeply saddened by her death. Rivers had attended his wedding to Camilla Parker Bowles in 2005. Then there's Janie Godley, a Scottish comedian, actress, and writer. She met Rivers a few years ago while performing at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe.
I reckon it was about 3 or 4 years ago, and Joan Rivers was there doing some one-woman shows, which was amazing. My daughter Ashley Story, who's also a stand-up, she ruined my figure in 1986 coming out my body, so I make her flyer as a penance for such a pain. And she's been flyering my show since she was 10. So she's out in the street going, come see my mum, come see my mum. And Joan Rivers was coming down the Royal Mile. She was largely ignoring a lot of the flyers who were so in awe. And then she heard Ashley saying, who wants to come see my mum's show? And obviously that struck a chord with her because she travels and works a lot with her daughter, Melissa. So she came over and she went, oh my God, you're flying for your mum's show. How sweet. And Ashley's like, yeah, you know, I broke her ovaries back in 1986. So this is the crap that I have to suffer. So she laughed at that. She said, and she saw the picture of me. She went, and your mum's a stand-up? And Ashley's like, yeah, I'm a stand-up. My mum's a stand-up. And she went, that is so awesome. So then about 40 minutes later, I was at the Gilded Balloon up in the loft bar, and our manager, who's a guy I know, he brought her in, and I went, oh my God, Joan Rivers, so lovely to meet you. And she went, hang on a minute, I saw your daughter in the Royal Mile. She's really tall, she's beautiful, she's so funny. Are you sure you're actually her mother? And that made me laugh, because that's very much a Joan Rivers thing to say.
So did Joan come to your show? Or did you go to hers? I mean, were you...
I went to hers. She didn't come to mine. She didn't go see much because, you know, she'd a lot of press and stuff. I remember when I owned a bar in the East End of Glasgow from 1979 till 1994. And I remember in the late 80s, somebody gave me a book called Enter Talking, and it was Joan Rivers' book. And I remember thinking, oh my God, a woman could be a stand-up. I never wanted to be a comedian in a bright, colourful jumper on a piano singing ditties in a lovely English accent. My comedy always was destined to be hard-hitting, hardcore, a bit filthy, a bit in there, the kind of comedy that would hit you with a brick.
Yeah, did Joan Rivers then give you licence, kind of in your own mind,
yes,
to do that?
Yeah, because all the women comics I had seen on... We didn't have Scottish women comics on TV, and actually we still don't, so nothing's changed there. But it was all English female comics on TV. It didn't resonate with me. I don't know people who spoke like that. And then we had women on pianos, we had women doing songs. Women were basically classed as light entertainment, whereas Joan Rivers was a stand-up that looked like she could also make men laugh. Because back then in the 80s, to me, female stand-ups were just there for the women when you were bored with the men. Whereas Joan Rivers transcended that and she could do both.
And you are, like Joan Rivers, kind of bold in your own humor. You talk about your rough and ready upbringing in Glasgow, running that pub that you were talking about, hanging out with gangsters. You smoke and you swear. So it kind of sounds like Joan Rivers gave you the key to unlock that part of your background. Otherwise, we wouldn't know about this part of it.
That's true. If it hadn't been for Joan Rivers being... I mean, to this day, it still irks me when I get in a cab or I meet somebody new and I say I'm a stand-up. One of the first things people say, oh, do you swear? Why are you asking if I swear? Is this 1952?
So do
and, and that's what she was like. She was like, what does it matter if I say a word? It's a word. And I think she said things that a lot of people thought. I disagreed with a lot of our stuff when she slagged off celebrities' dressing. You know, like women, oh my God, that dress, where did you get that? Did you strip a dog? I don't care about what women wear to the Oscars or what women wear. I would love women to turn up at the Oscars and the Emmys dressed in a Guantanamo Bay boiler suit, because then people would focus on how good they're talented. I was once asked at an event, what are you wearing? And I said, clothes that will cover my vagina and breasts so the public don't scream. That's what I'm wearing.
So. Janie, do us all a big favor, please. Can you channel Joan Rivers to the best of your ability and hit us with your best one-liner on the Scottish referendum on independence coming up?
Well, it's actually my daughter's joke, so I'm going to have to do my daughter's joke. My daughter's 28. She still lives at home. And as she says, independence has never been a big issue in her life. She still lets her mum pay the rent. As far as I'm concerned, I think the referendum should be a great day. I want independence. I want to be a woman that lives in a country that's owned by its own people, just because I could finally get rid of those two pandas that can't have sex in Edinburgh Zoo. It's unusual to see something with two black eyes and no children in Scotland.
Oh dear. Scottish comedian Janie Godley, definitely skirting, if not crossing, the line of good taste, just like the late Joan Rivers. Janey was poking fun there at the upcoming referendum on Scottish independence, but for many Scots, the vote is no laughing matter, especially for one family in Oban on Scotland's western coast. Corey Princell has our story.
It's Tuesday afternoon. School is out, and the race is on. High schoolers in black uniforms pour through the gates of the Oban train station. They leap onto the train, trying to find just the right place to sit.
In the middle, in the middle, in the middle, in the middle, in the middle. In the middle.
Right here.
This is the kind of thing that can matter a lot at this age. But right now, many teenagers in Scotland have something more momentous on their minds. Last summer, Scottish lawmakers on both sides of the yes-no divide passed a bill giving kids as young as 16 the right to vote in the upcoming referendum. For young Scots, it's a possibly life-changing question. Should Scotland be an independent country?
Scotland can kind of stand its own 2 feet, but it's a question of should it.
16-year-old James Kane is on his way home from school. He got interested in the referendum and was invited to join a special BBC Scotland program called Generation 2014. It's following 50 young Scottish voters in the lead-up to the vote, online, on the radio, and on TV. This spring, James participated in a town hall-style debate in Oban.
But I wanted to draw on a point that I didn't think touched on before, is that I'm talented. My friends over there are talented. The youth of Scotland is talented. So
after that debate, he got an idea. He'd go to Edinburgh, the Scottish capital, and he'd try to interview some of Scotland's top politicians, the people who might run an independent Scotland. To his surprise, a number of them, both for and against independence, agreed to talk, and the BBC filmed it.
First of all, I think you've got to look at what the benefits are of being in the United Kingdom.
You know, we've got embassies all over the world, we've got a single market.
Do we want to separate ourselves off? Do we want to create barriers?
I can't imagine anything more exciting.
James's parents couldn't have been more proud.
Hello. Hi, James. Hi.
Kevin and Anna Kane used to live in England. They moved to Tainault, not far from Oban in western Scotland, after James was born. Kevin and Anna consider themselves British, and they weren't inclined to support the Scottish independence movement or even think much about politics at all, particularly Kevin.
I have never voted, not from a lack of interest or apathy or I can't be bothered. I felt I couldn't have my voice heard because on the ballot paper there was no box that said none of the above.
But then, says Anna, their son got interested in the referendum debate.
As a parent, you like to try and support your children, and we were just supporting him in the process of understanding information and then found that he was actually explaining things to us.
Yeah, pretty good.
So we've learned a lot from him.
Yeah, we've had a lot of lively debates around the dinner table of evenings. It's been actually it's a very interesting year because it's been a never-ending topic for discussion at dinner time.
Kevin Kane went along on the day James did his interviews with politicians in Edinburgh. He says he met Scottish politicians who seemed genuine and passionate, and they made time for his teenage son. Kevin's now sure he'll vote later this month. He's just not sure which way.
Find it really hard? What do you think,
I'm finding it really difficult. I'm leaning, today, the swingometer is, is over more towards a yes.
Kevin seems to agree, kind of.
I do not want to split up the UK. Yeah, really don't want to do it. I think that's a bad idea. Yep. But I, looking at it, and can say, well, there are things that need addressed. We've tried to address them through the status quo, and it's just not happened. If we do want to create a fairer and more just society, there seems to be only an option to vote yes.
These days, their son, James Kane, likes to say he's not undecided, he's unconvinced.
Even now, I'm lost. I'm trying to find the best information for me. But no, as a wide statement, I'd say that the best thing that a person needs to vote in Scottish independence is actually finding out what they want and what things really, really matter to them.
This summer, James says he learned a lot about his own potential. Interviewing those politicians took gumption. His parents say James has grown up a lot. And, says his mother, he's not the only one.
Hundreds of thousands of 16 and 17-year-olds who've suddenly looked out there into the real world and thought, hang on a minute, what does happen out there? You know, how are decisions made? And they're really, when they come to vote, you know, in a national election in a couple of years' time, they're really going to be switched on about them. They're going to be politically engaged.
Switched on is a good way to describe many Scots ahead of the vote. Turnout at the referendum is expected to be high. For the World, I'm Corey Princell in Tainault, Scotland.
When Julia Child landed on the scene, a lot of people in the U.S. considered French food exotic. But now we Americans are used to global cuisine. Northern Thai street food, no problem. Brazilian feijoada, bring it on. Which means we should be ready for Nikkei and Chifa. If you're guessing those are culinary styles from Asia, you're not far off. They're actually Peruvian, but with serious Asian twists. And food writer Steve Dolinsky is sampling them both in Peru's capital, Lima. Steve, I'm going to guess that Nikkei is Japanese-based cooking. What about Chifa?
Chifa is Chinese, and the Chinese make up about 2 to 3% of Peru's population, just under a million people. It's this fascinating style of cuisine I had never seen before. I didn't know it existed in Peru. A lot of it stems from Chinese immigration here after independence in Peru, kind of late 1850s, 1860s. Chinese came here to work the plantations, sugar plantations, build railroads, tap rubber trees, and they stayed. And they sort of created their own cuisine based on what was available here locally. Great example of a chifa dish is a dish called arroz chaufa. That's just fried rice. But instead of seeing it with like bell peppers or pineapple or something you'd see in America or broccoli, here they have it topped with big giant corn kernels. And if you know, there's hundreds of different varieties of corn in Peru. So you'd see these big giant corn kernels embedded throughout the fried rice, or the fried chicken we'd see like in a sweet and sour chicken. Here is topped with maracuya, which is passion fruit sauce. So very different mashup for the Chinese Peruvian.
What about Nikkei cuisine, which is based in Japanese food? I mean, would you find Nikkei and Chifa in the same restaurant or in different places?
Typically, restaurants are going to be either Chifa or Nikkei. And the Nikkei from the Japanese, they're even smaller, about 1.5% of the population in Peru. And the immigrants really started coming in late 1890s. For sugar plantation work, and the Japanese would end up just staying here, marrying Peruvians. And one of the most fascinating mashups I've seen is a place here called Maido. It just got ranked like 7th best restaurant in Latin America. Mitsuharu Tsumura, his father is from Osaka, his mother is Peruvian. And he's got this really high-end approach to Nikkei cuisine. I spoke to him recently, and he kind of told me how Peru loves to absorb different cultures, including the country's best-known dish.
Peru has been like a sponge. Instead of rejecting other cultures, we have made them ours, you know. One of the top 10 dishes of Peru, which is called lomo saltado, which is a sauteed tenderloin. It's done in the wok, and it has a soy sauce as the main sauce of the recipe. And you think, hey, you know, soy sauce is not one of our ingredients, you know, that came from China and Japan. So that's almost as famous as ceviche.
Wow, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, and they've also, I mean, the Japanese have influenced, you know, the way they cut fish, the way they serve fish here. I mean, the seafood is so plentiful here in the Pacific. And you see a lot of Japanese restaurants here, and the sushi service is amazing. But like at his restaurant, Maido, he'll have grilled pigeon on top of some rice as a nigiri sushi. They really employ a lot of the ingredients. In fact, the most famous Japanese chef in America, at least, Nobu Matsuhisa, has Nobus all over the world. He was here in Lima in the 70s, and that really influenced his cuisine. He created things like the hamachi jalapeno, which you'd see at every Nobu restaurant now. So the Japanese and Peruvian mashup is really, it's not only fascinating, but it's awfully delicious.
I was curious about that because a lot of sushi places in this country are now trying to experiment with more kind of local produce in their sushi, but it sounds like all that kind of started down in Peru.
It really did. I mean, it was really just born by necessity. The Japanese chefs would come here. They could not find a lot of the ingredients, you know, shichimi peppers or edamame or the things that they would see back home. One of the dishes at Maido was kui, which is the guinea pig down here. You see kui everywhere.
I was going to ask you about that. Have they done any riffs on guinea pig yet, deep-fried guinea pig?
Oh, yeah. There's actually a delicious riff. Some of my friends, you know, sort of turned their nose up and they said, you know, you're going to eat guinea pig? They debone it, first of all, and they slow cook it. They confit it in its own in fat, and then they debone it. They saute it, and then the chef here serves it with yuca cream and kind of this interesting barbecue sauce and really makes it delicious. So they take these local indigenous ingredients and give them a little bit of an Asian spin, and it's just, I've never seen anything like it before.
Steve Dolinsky speaking with us from Lima, Peru's capital. Thanks so much. Enjoy the food.
You bet, Marco. Thanks.
grilled pigeon sushi. You do have to see it to believe it. We've got some of Steve Dolinsky's fabulous photos from Peru on our Instagram feed. We're at instagram.com/PRI the world. And coming up in a few minutes, right here on the radio, remembering Argentine rocker Gustavo Cerati. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Imagine you live in paradise, but your job takes you to hell. That's what our next story is about. UN peacekeepers from the Pacific nation of Fiji, who are now stationed in Iraq. Hermione G. visited their base in Erbil, the capital of northern Iraq's Kurdistan region, and as you'll hear, she discovered an unusual part of their training program.
The United Nations compound in Erbil is an austere wilderness of asphalt, cement, and blast walls, peppered with nondescript buildings where the organization's employees live and work.
We are known as the United Nations Guard Unit, so we provide security for the facilities and equipment and camp areas for the United Nations.
Major Mikhail Radumu is in charge of 68 troops that recently moved to Erbil from Baghdad. 5 days a week, at dawn and dusk, the drab landscape is briefly transformed by a Christian choir. Radumu, like all members of his battalion, is from the Fiji Islands.
Right back from childhood, you know, we do this. Part of a village setup back at home is communal activity. And part of it is singing as well, both in religious activities and traditional activities. And for us, it's just natural. If anyone starts singing, every other people around comes in harmonizing.
The Fijian Army Battalion has been stationed in Iraq since 2004 and is charged with protecting UN personnel and facilities in the country. It's been an even greater responsibility since the withdrawal of international troops in 2011, and especially now with a threat from Islamic State militants sweeping across the country. Radumu says singing together actually helps the peacekeepers meet that challenge.
In a military setup, spiritual and physical are correlated. It enhances us physically. So this is what we do in the morning, evening, and it keeps us, it binds us together. There's a bond that we develop doing these things, and it keeps us strong during times such as this.
Naomi Tora is one of 9 women who work as security guards with the unit. She's very aware of the risks that her job carries. Even in their peacekeeping capacity, 5 of her colleagues have been killed in the line of duty while in Iraq.
We, the Fiji Army, who have been chosen to come and work for UN, every day when we get a briefing, they always tell us that the weapons that we have and what all we've come to use here, they don't match at all to whatever forces that are coming from outside. So we believe that there is a great force that looks after us all and has power over everything. That is why we always try to better how we serve him.
Music, she says, is one way to do that.
Worship, singing, takes us closer to the God that we're serving, who we believe is looking after us as we're looking after this place.
The soldiers say they're praying for their colleagues being held captive in Syria and hope perhaps they too are allowed the chance to sing at least once each day. For The World, I'm Hermione G., Erbil, northern Iraq.
Remember when John Lennon died? A terrible day, and for Beatles fans, an especially sad moment, because it was the definitive news that there would never be a Beatles reunion. Similar story today in Buenos Aires. The legendary Argentine rock band Soda Stereo will no longer be able to reunite, and that's because Gustavo Cerati, the trio's lead singer and co-founder, died yesterday at the age of 55. If you're of a certain age, actually pretty much any age, and you go to a party in Argentina and other places in Latin America, you're likely to hear this Soda Stereo hit, De Música Ligera.
Calor de las masas y yo desperté queriendo soñarla.
Our colleague with the BBC, Veronica Smink, is in Buenos Aires. Veronica, what's the mood today in the capital? Can you hear Soda Stereo blasting out of car windows and homes?
Yes, well, the mood is really sad, and it's accompanied as well because it's a very dark, rainy day here. So I think that matches the mood of many people who are definitely, yes, you can hear cars going by playing his songs, even stores. Today, I took the train and got off in one of the main train stations, Retiro, and, you know, one of the stores was playing one of his famous songs. So definitely Cerati is on everybody's mind today.
I mean, Cerati had been in a coma for several years after he had a stroke, but I guess the love of this band, Soda Stereo, never waned. What do you think made it one of the most popular acts ever? And I'm talking not just in Argentina, but in all of South America.
No, definitely. And you can see that by all the messages, you know, that are coming in still everywhere from all parts of Latin America, even from the States as well. I think a lot of people recognize that Soda Stereo was one of the first groups to play concerts all around the region, you know, a lot of tours. And a lot of people also think that that the band was highly influential for other rock bands in Latin America. They were like the first massive Latin American band. So yes, definitely all over Latin America and in many parts of the world, people are really sad. A lot of people had the hope, you know, while Cerati was in coma for the last 4 years, a lot of people were in hope that he was actually going to wake up one day and, you know, that the dream of the reunion would happen again. So people are very sad that that's never, ever going to happen now.
And I gather in the streets of Buenos Aires among Soda Stereo fans, they're actually quoting some famous words of Cerati that he delivered at the final concert the band gave some years ago.
Yes, in 1997, they famously played for the last time. And at the very end of the concert, Cerati ended with the words, "Gracias totales," thanks totally. He later explained that basically he didn't know what to say and that came out. But those words became so famous that most of the fans honoring him yesterday and today, you know, posted those very same words, "Gracias totales."
Veronica Smink with the BBC in Buenos Aires. Gracias totales to you, too. Thanks for telling us about Gustavo Cerati. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
Gracias totales.
So long, Gustavo Cerati. We posted a video of that Soda Stereo hit, De Música Ligera, on our Global Hit Facebook page. That's also a great place to find some of our other musical highlights. It's all at facebook.com/globalhit. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us, and have yourselves a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.